This is GabFest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's Political GabFest, we'll preview the Republican National Convention in Tampa. We'll also discuss the deafening uproar caused by Missouri Senate candidate Todd Akin's comments about legitimate rape.
I used the wrong words in the wrong way, and for that I apologize.
And another uproar, this one over Newsweek columnist Neil Ferguson's article telling President Obama to hit the road. I'm David Plotz.
And I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Culture GabFest, we'll discuss whether the world needs more critical critics. Also, Time Machine Chefs, a new cooking show that purports to teach us whether today's chefs could hack it in ancient kitchens. And reassessing a movie classic.
Make 'em laugh, make 'em laugh.
Don't Does Singin' in the Rain merit yet another revival? We'll start with politics right after the news.
Hello and welcome to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm David Plotz, the editor of Slate. And today we want to extend a special welcome to all of you listening on the radio. After 7 years of podcasting on Slate, 7 fat years, we've joined up with WNYC in New York to turn our two most popular podcasts into this very radio show. For the first half, you'll hear the Slate Political GabFest. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll grudgingly relinquish the microphones to the Culture GabFest team for their half of the show. So let's jump right in. I'm joined by GabFest regular John Dickerson, Slate's chief political correspondent and political director of CBS News, and by Hannah Rosen, the Atlantic Monthly senior editor, editor of Slate's XX, also my wife.
Hi.
Our first topic today is the Republican convention, which gets underway in Tampa next week, an orgy of elephant hats, American flag jackets, and wondrous lapel pins of enormous size.
And that's just what I'll be wearing.
Do you have a lapel pin, John?
Not associated with politics.
And how big is your flag pin,
yeah,
John? That's the important question.
Yeah, you could serve dinner on my flag pin.
So the Romney nomination was settled months ago. Paul Ryan was chosen weeks ago. Hannah, what is the purpose of having a convention in this age?
I'm a little counterintuitive here. I think only political reporters think conventions are boring. I don't think most people think conventions are boring. And I particularly don't think this convention is going to be boring. You're looking
really?
At me
that
like
is a
you
counter,
are so...
That is a very counterintuitive
Look,
argument.
Look, most Americans pay no attention to politics, and then comes the convention, and then it's like a pageantry. And that's as interesting as politics is going to get. And so I feel it's slightly bogus when political reporters say things like, oh, no policy happens. Like, you were going to write about policy if it did happen. Like, all you do is write about, like, image and message for the entire year, and then the convention comes and you complain because it's only about image and message. And so, I mean, particularly in this election, it's like, what's our problem with Romney is that his image is slightly off, right? So this is the moment to fix that. What's the problem with Obama? His message is not quite clear, or he's not getting it out. So ta-da, a convention solves that problem, right?
Are you channeling Dickerson? Dickerson
no,
is so
God,
delightful.
God love her.
No,
wait, he likes conventions
that?
Too?
Well, he wanted a good defense of conventions made, not by him.
Right. I mean, I like conventions. But the other knock against political reporters is that they love conventions because they all kind of have these romantic feelings about the 1960 convention and then the 1964 convention. You know, George
How
Romney
old
walks
are you?
Out. Well, even you, the whole gig in political coverage is to pretend you're older than you are. So I'm going to speak about the 60 convention as if I was there, hair
right.
slicked back, skinny tie. But they think of all this drama. Now, that kind of drama actually doesn't exist, but we do still have real and interesting drama. Remember, Barack Obama in 2004 gave a speech that is still the signature speech probably of his political life. In 1992,
That's
Pat
sad,
Buchanan,
by the way.
Well,
like, that's a thing to fix at this convention.
Well, perhaps. But, you know, as you quite rightly point out, it is a part of the president, you know, running for president. And so it shouldn't be the whole thing, shouldn't be the whole ball of wax. But, you know, in Pat Buchanan in 1992. So things happen that are interesting.
So the theme, obviously, Hannah, you touched on this already, but the theme clearly is to humanize the half human, half robot Mitt Romney, to make it seem as if he is an actual person and not a pile of money running for president. So what is it that they're going to do, John, to make him seem human? And it seems to me there's a wonderful opportunity because only 23% of people, I think he's more likable than Barack Obama.
He has a steep hill to climb on the likability question, whether it's compared to President Obama or just whether people like him or don't like him. He's still, as they say, underwater. More people don't like him than like him. But it's not just Mitt Romney they try and reintroduce at these conventions. It's what they try and do with all candidates. And I think the model for him is 1992. Bill Clinton came into the convention with very high unfavorables, close to Romney's, although I don't think is bad. And they reintroduced him as the man from hope. And they use, you know, film and Hollywood and Madison Avenue and all these things to repackage Bill Clinton that Democrats will now say are proof of the phoniness of Mitt Romney. But if Romney does it right, he will duplicate what Bill Clinton did in 1992 in terms of selling a kind of comfortable package. Now, the question is, do they have the material to work with? Clinton came from, you know, modest means. What are they going to do in introducing Mitt Romney? I think what they'll do is he will be Mr. Fix-It. You know, this is a competent guy who's been able to turn things around, and that's who he is. They will try to make, you know, show us the inner Romney, but I think the bigger thing will be, you know, Mr. Fix-It.
I want to make fun of Don a little bit because another funny thing about political reporters is it's like, so you start the convention, like all these stories about how they're going to stage manage Romney and make it look like he's in his living room and bring his wife and kid. Isn't this a message I care thing? Like if you're saying before the convention you're going to humanize the candidate, doesn't that sort of cut against the effort to humanize the candidate a little bit?
Well, also, but what John's talking about is not humanizing. John, you're talking about like Mr. Fix-It.
Yeah.
I think they should humanize him. You think they should Mr. Fix-It?
Well, I just think that the Mr. Fix-It-ize him is the message that's going to come through. They're going to try and do both. But I think Mr. Fix-It is the message that comes through, is going to come through.
Yeah, like they had a description of the stage and it said, we're going to make it look like a living room and there's going to be a clock up there which shows the budget ticking up. Because I definitely have a clock like that in my living room, right?
Well,
so it's
right.
Like you're trying to do both of those things at once. Well, and
but isn't, to your point, though, the earlier point you made, which is that most people aren't paying attention, the reason you telegraph what you're going to do is that when people do tune in, the frame in through which it's reported is, you know, here's the guy. Like they're trying to make this comfortable. They're willing to kind of take a knock in terms of being kind of overt about their strategy because they want to transmit the underlying fact. And they think the best way for political reporters who love process to transmit the underlying fact, which is that he's a you know, approachable fellow, is to do it through process.
I want them, one, to put Ann Romney and their beautiful children and their beautiful grandchildren.
Right.
I think they should have them out there because I
yeah.
know you. There's some sort of Stepford.
They're like way too Stepford, beautiful.
There's some Stepford element, but they should have that. And I think they need to talk about his religion and they need to talk about his role in his religion.
Yes.
I really think they need to do that.
Yes.
And people will accept it. I know that's a thing which they, by not talking about it, they've made it seem alien and difficult. That's the thing to embrace where his humanity is, and I would do that.
I was going to ask you guys about that. That's actually the one thing that's been mentioned that I think could totally work and is genuine, because that's the one part of him that's really an underdog. You know, you can make a good narrative around the idea that Mormonism has been embattled, but it's his genuine faith, and it's not only fueled him and, you know, humanizes him, but it's also part of the reason why he is good at fixing things. So I think Mormonism sort of gets you a long way, especially since we're at the moment where Americans are about to accept it. Like, you couldn't have done it in the last campaign, but you can totally do it in this campaign. We're sort of primed to receive that message now.
I don't know. The polling doesn't suggest we're primed. People still have pretty – I mean, there are enough people who have negative feelings about the Mormon religion that I think that this would be a risky move. I think they want to certainly access the fact that he has been faithful to and a devoutly practicing religious person. Voters like their candidates to be people of faith. But I think they're not going to do that in the convention.
They should. John, quickly, what is the Democratic pre-Buttle strategy here? What are they going to do to try to minimize the Romney bounce, and to what can they do besides have a hurricane strike it during the middle of Mitt Romney's speech and the lights go out that would make it a failure?
They want to try and make its success act as a weight against Romney, which is to the extent that Romney puts on a show that puts him in the best light, the more people are convinced that he is an approachable, good guy, Mr. Fix-It. Every good feeling you have, they want you to think about that good feeling in the context of manufacturedness and that it's not authentic and that hidden behind that good feeling are all of these, you know, dangerous things.
Okay. Let's go to our second topic, Todd Akin. Who had even heard his name a week ago? So the Missouri Republican Senate candidate was just another conservative running for a close seat, cruising perhaps to election. Maybe not cruising, but he had a tough fight for election. But he then went on local television on Sunday and he said this.
From what I understand from doctors, that's really rare. If it's a legitimate rape, the female body has ways to try to shut that whole thing down. But let's assume that maybe that didn't work or something.
Aiken has since attempted to clarify. He said that he meant forcible rape. When he said legitimate rape, he said this is the essential position of the Republican Party, which it is. The Republican platform, which we didn't discuss a minute ago, but the Republican platform, which is just approved, has a anti-abortion plank with no exceptions for rape in it. What Aiken is saying is essentially the position of Paul Ryan, the vice presidential nominee. Yet, at the same time, the entire Republican apparatus is pushing to get Aiken out of the race. Aiken missed one chance to get out of the race this week. He stayed in despite the efforts of Paul Ryan, Mitt Romney, even Sarah Palin to get him out. There seems to be another potential out for him in September. We'll see if he takes it then. But, Hanna, why do they want him out so badly if his position is not antithetical to what the party itself stands for?
The answer is embedded in your question. They do not want anyone to think that his position is the mainstream of the Republican Party. So it's much better to think that somebody like Aiken is on the fringe and belongs with this guy, Jack Wilkie, who is the origin of this unscientific science that Aiken is talking about. So I think they just don't want you to think this is the main. They don't want you to think about this platform, even though this has been in the Republican Party platform, has had no exceptions for the last 12 years. They just don't want you to think about that. And I think this is a tension in a lot of conventions, is you want to keep in the background a lot of the more social conservative stuff, especially right now. You don't want to talk about it a lot, and Aiken brings it to the fore.
So, John, is it going to hurt the Romney campaign that Aiken said this and that the Republican Party platform doesn't have this rape exception? Is this going to really feed the war on women narrative that the Democrats are so eager for?
It's definitely fed it. And we should remember the Obama campaign was going after this ground before anybody knew about Congressman Todd Aiken. And that was running an ad in which they basically said Mitt Romney's position was the platform position, even though Romney several times had said that his position is anti-abortion rights with an exception for rape and incest. And he'd said that out loud many, many times. But had then at another time said, I support the platform. And so does Aiken make it that much worse for Romney? Yeah, I'm feeling like it may for this short period, but that it won't in 3 weeks.
What's weird, Hanna, is the way in which the rape exception or the lack of, that everyone is for the rape exception. Even if you look at extreme conservatives, there's not a majority of support for no rape exception. Even if you look at the most extreme religious people, there's not a majority of support. Everyone has a majority support for a rape exception.
They must not think about it all that much. I mean, if you're it's a completely inconsistent position. I mean, I guess it's just your sympathy lies with the person who's been raped, so you make an exception. I think what it's about is a little reluctance about the pro-life position. It's just like a little bit of an out.
So one thing I'm interested in, and John, maybe you can engage with me on this, is the way in which local politics has become nationalized. There, people have said, I think Ezra Klein made this point, that in a previous generation, a thing like this that Todd Aiken said on a local TV station would just have been a local, bumbling Senate candidate says something stupid and that it becomes an issue in the Missouri papers, the Kansas City Star writes about it, but it doesn't become a national issue. There's a way in which all politics has become national, and I think it has to do with the sort of increasingly parliamentary nature of American politics, where we have parties rather than individuals who are sort of running. Is there a way for anything to stay local these days?
Well, in this sense, in this part of it's technological. The smallest thing you say and the local anything becomes global in a second. The other thing, though, what gave this energy is the number of Republicans and the speed with which they moved to get rid of him. And why did they do that? For purely political reasons. And it's the same reason they didn't do much when Senator David Vitter was found to have gone to prostitutes. Vitter was in a seat that if he'd stepped down, the Democratic governor of the state would have taken a seat away from the Republicans. So the sense of outrage was far, 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 far less his case. In this case, this is a seat that was behind Nebraska, the second one that Republicans thought they could pick up on their way to needing 4 or 5 to take control of the Senate. Right. And also, by the way, I mean, we should note the primacy of politics in another way, which is as far as I can tell, 90% of the fury is about him not running for the Senate, not whether he should give up his position in the House, which presumably if it's a great crime.
What is he asking forgiveness for?
Misspeaking. So he meant to say forcible rape. He said legitimate rape. By the way, the other part was the science of what he said.
Right.
It wasn't just the word, the notion of legitimate or not legitimate rape, which is crazy. It was then this science behind it that was
right. So, but that's what it was. It was that forcible rape causes you ladies to have stress hormones.
I know.
Released.
I'm shutting down right now because
you are shutting
so aggressive that I can't take it.
Are you shut down?
Yes.
Hanna has shut down. Let's move on to our third topic. Coming up, a conservative Harvard professor gets an F for his anti-Obama article. You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm David Plotz, along with John Dickerson and Hannah Rosen. And this is the political GabFest portion of the show. Okay, let's go to our third main topic. Oh, the delight of seeing two ill-tempered aggro people pound each other to a pulp, in particular when one of them is so right and the other is so wrong. So round one, Harvard historian and conservative polemicist Neil Ferguson wrote an excoriating cover story in Newsweek called Hit the Road, Barack, which incidentally is a terrible headline, just a terrible headline.
Well, they can't be blamed for that.
No, it's hit, because in British it's Hit the Road, Barack, and so it rhymes with Jack, exactly.
That's a good point. I didn't even think about that. Which posits both a sort of intellectual and polemical case against President Obama's reelection. Ferguson, who opposed Obama in 2008 and is an explicit Romney supporter, made no bones about his partisanship in the piece, but he did sort of draw on his credibility as a historian to argue that Obama has weakened foreign policy, that he's damaged the economy, and that he's bankrupted the country. And then round two, every lefty writer in the country, and especially lefty economics writer in the country, but notably Paul Krugman, who was an intellectual of the same weight or perhaps greater weight than Ferguson, jumped on top of Ferguson and attacked the errors in the piece, or the errors and misleading data they said were in the piece. Notably, Ferguson's claim that Obamacare would cost $1.2 trillion, and Ferguson had said that this Congressional Budget Office gave that number, that it would cost the country $1.2 trillion. Turns out the Congressional Budget Office said no such thing at all. In fact, that Obamacare would probably save money. Other attacks for him cherry-picking data about unemployment, including saying that all job losses since the beginning of 2008 should be held accountable to President Obama.
Which is a year before.
A year before he was elected. Right. Yes, that President Obama is responsible for all those job losses. So, John, first of all, do the facts in this case matter? And second of all, does this fight – what's important about this fight, if anything?
Huh. Well, the facts should matter. And I guess what I dislike about a lot of the things that are just called, you know, polemics is that basically if you're a polemicist, you can just say any old damn thing you want. And, oh, isn't it an entertaining article, and bully for him, and, oh, he really takes him down. The facts here should and do matter, which isn't to say that lots of people don't, you know, massage the facts to make their argument. This was of an order. This is of a different order. This was beyond massaging. But I think also this says something about Newsweek, the brand, which is far different than what it used to be, you know, one of the leading news magazines. They would rather have something that's sort of cheeky and that creates a controversy than something that used to be fact-checked to a fare-thee-well. Having worked at a news magazine, I know what it was like. It was, you know, you said the sun came up. Are you sure that the sun came up? And that's obviously gone out the window now.
Back in 1960 when her hair was slicked back. So, Hannah, Jim Fallows of your publication, The Atlantic, said that Harvard should be ashamed of having Neil Ferguson on the faculty, given the intellectual dishonesty of what he wrote. Should Harvard be ashamed? Should Ferguson be held to a different standard because he is a professor than a conservative polemicist?
No, I think the Newsweek should be held to a different standard. I process this initially as a media story. It's like, why did Newsweek run this on this cover? I'm not sure. And I also found the response very frustrating and picayune. There's kind of nobody did the broad response to him. Everybody did the picking apart of data after data. I think what you had to do is recognize that this was polemics and here's like give me the big picture about supply side economics and what he had wrong. Instead, it was like chart versus chart versus chart versus chart. And it was hard to process what was broadly wrong, which, you know, we can talk about now.
But if someone says that the moon is made of cheese, you don't do you have to go to the broader context? I mean, doesn't that when you count job losses a year before the man was even elected, you are not operating in a realm where the traditional rules of argument should need to apply, I think.
Well, I guess I was yearning for a polemic to answer the polemic.
But the polemics don't answer.
But isn't that what Krugman was, essentially?
No, Krugman was very specific. One thing which interests me about this is something that has happened to the Republican Party, which is sort of surprising. The Republican Party used to be a party of academia. The Republican Party used to have a lot of professors and a lot of the ivory tower were people who were aligned with the Republican Party. And that the anti-intellectualism of the party, I think, has lost them a lot of intellectual credibility, which is why people who would be Republicans who are intellectual lights are kind of made queasy by it.
Right.
But you still have, I mean, Kevin Hassett, Glenn Hubbard, Greg Mankiw, John Taylor. You have economists with people may disagree.
There are a few, but it's a relatively small number when you look at it. And each one of those people gets lionized because the Republican Party needs it. They need the intellectual support. But there isn't the kind of heavyweight intellectual life in the Republican Party the way there was a generation ago. We will leave it on that. Let's go on to cocktail chatter. The one awesome story detail, something that you'll be sharing with a room full of drunken reporters in Tampa. John Dickerson.
Well, it's not new news, especially to the drunken room of reporters, and they'll all move away from me when I mention this. But the Kaiser Family Foundation and the Washington Post put some numbers behind the intense polarization that we hear about so much. And in 1998, they did a poll. And they found that 41% of Republicans and 45% of Democrats said they considered themselves strong partisans. They did that poll again recently. Those numbers are now up to 65 and 62%. In 98, 24% of Republicans said that government controls too much of daily life. Now it's up to 63%. So those are big numbers. But the point is, when we have these conventions, you know, nothing's going to be any less polarized when whoever our next president is. And yet neither side really has a theme or theory for how they're going to govern in a partisanship that will be worse than we've ever seen it before.
OK, Hannah, what's your chatter?
So in honor of vice presidential candidate Paul Ryan's favorite workout, which is called the P90X, his particular form of intense workout, I want to recommend a This American Life podcast from last week, which is called Operation Flex, which is about possibly the most incompetent FBI sting ever done. And it is just a fabulous yarn full of fantastic characters. And I recommend you all listen to it.
And does it involve people working out in it?
One big dude working out, trying to get other Muslim dudes to confess things while working out. It's hilarious. It's just definitely going to be made into a movie. It's fabulous.
My chatter, Judge Richard Posner. Hannah, you're going to like this one. The philosopher, the polymath, the crank, has a wonderful review of a book. I don't even have the title of the book. The review is called Working 9 to 12, but it's a book about leisure time, if you'd like. And it's a kind of fantasy dating back to probably before Karl Marx that would be better if we all just worked a few hours and then had leisure in the afternoon to go do whatever we want and to do philosophy and criticism in the evening. All we really crave is more leisure time. But Posner kind of demolishes this argument in a wonderful way. He points out, first of all, that people who only work half time, who work a few hours, their skills are not going to improve. They're not going to be good at what they do. They're going to be just less good workers in general than people who work all the time. Second of all, yes, the theory where we just work less but are more productive, we can have a decent life. Well, we can have the life with a lower standard of living. We won't get the benefits that come from people working harder, namely faster internet, more goods in the stores, you know, more food choices, all the things that we actually like about modern life won't happen because, yeah, we could work half the time and have a standard of living from 1910, but we'd have a standard of living from 1910. So there's that part of the argument. The other part, which I really like, is he says that, in fact, people with lots of leisure do not really have a great life. That if you look at the English leisure class of the 19th and early 20th century, what did they do with all that leisure time? They brawled, they overate, they drank too much, they wasted the day away. And actually, we like to work. People like to work. They're fulfilled by work. And yes, we have probably less leisure than we would optimally have, but we earn it and we enjoy it more than we would.
Oh, my God. I hate this argument. It's a horrible argument. Okay, here, I'm giving you a choice. Would you like to spend the next 2 hours hanging out in a bar, drinking a couple of beers, or sitting at your very fast internet and looking up very fast things on your internet? Like, what's the comparison? I'm not buying any of the things he wants me to do with my time. It just seems like a life of ever greater slavery to my desk.
You work too hard. Okay, that'll do it for the political GabFest portion of the show. I'm David Plotz in Washington, turning things over to Stephen in New York.
Thanks, David. I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture GabFest Tasty Medieval Cock and Trice Edition.
I'm singing in the rain, just singing in the rain.
On today's show, the 60th anniversary of Singing in the Rain, a consensus American classic. Then the explosion of TV food shows. And finally, reviewing nicely, is it more of a sin or an obligation? Joining me today are Slate's deputy editor, Julia Turner. Hello, Julia.
Hi, Steve.
And, of course, Slate's film critic, Dana Stevens. Hey, Dana.
Hey, Steven.
And I should say welcome to all of our new listeners at WNYC. We're so excited to be gabbing to you today. Julia, what percentage of these people do you think knows what a medieval cock and trice is? Give me a hard number.
I did not know what a medieval cock and trice was.
So zero.
Until prep for this week's show.
Exactly.
At least 18.
You're the high watermark for knowledge of things like medieval cock and trices. I should say we will find out later on in our second segment of the show exactly what a medieval cock and trice is and what makes it so tasty. In the meantime, Singing in the Rain. Dana, you're Slate's film critic. Let me start with you. This is not a pop quiz, but do you know what Singing in the Rain has in common with both Casablanca and Citizen Kane?
Something about lists and appearing at the high end of them?
Well, exactly. They're ubiquitous on every single very top of every single best films of all time lists. None of them was a hit when they first came out. It's not totally shocking with Citizen Kane or Casablanca, perhaps, but kind of gobsmacking. I didn't realize that Singing in the Rain wasn't a huge hit when it first came out. It was via Roger Ebert, I've discovered, that it only became a popular and part of the permanent repertory of great American films in the late 50s.
Right. It didn't win any Oscars when it came out. It was a mild success.
It barely made the top 10 box office list the year it came out. Anyway, it's 60th anniversary now. It's also, I should say, the 100th anniversary of Gene Kelly's birth. And it's out on a new super double doodaddy Blu-ray disc. We rewatched the film, and I'm dying to know, what do you think of Singing in the Rain?
Well, it's too bad you're starting with me because I really feel almost just stupefied by the wonderfulness of this movie. It's kind of one of those moments when critical discourse fails you because it's hard to look at this movie with a critical eye. It's such a packet of pleasure on so many levels. It's just such a kind of perfect surface. The colors are incredible. The music is beautiful. And the actors are appealing. And it's really sort of impossible to watch it without just being drawn into the joy of it all. So I have no critical distance to respond to your question.
Julia, I'm going to get to you in 1 second. But first, let's listen to a number from this great Hollywood musical. This is Good Morning with, of course, Gene Kelly, Donald O'Connor, and Debbie Reynolds.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We've talked the whole night through.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Good morning. Good morning. It's great to stay up late. Good morning. Good morning to you.
That has to be one of my favorite songs in a musical of all time. It's one of those songs that once you hear it, you'll be singing it for a week. But the thing that I love most about it, and the thing that I really love about the music in this musical generally, is that it really is about a very specific moment and a specific feeling. I think sometimes in musicals you get songs that are about like an operatic idea of a feeling, like love or betrayal or this or that. And this is about you've been up all night with your friends. You're kind of working through life's troubles together. They're eating peanut butter and jellies, it looks like.
And glasses of milk.
And glasses of milk around the table after this premiere that's gone terribly badly as they're lamenting the failed future career of Gene Kelly's character. He puts a gigantic block of Havarti back in the fridge. Just the details are beautiful. And then they have this song of midnight brainstorming and collaboration and fun. And it's like, who hasn't had a night like that? And how many representations of that kind of midnight passion of the friendship intellectual kind do you see represented on film with Fantabulous Dancing? Mm. But Steve, before you move forward, I have to call you on your intro saying that we all sat down to rewatch this movie because you admitted to us when we decided to do this segment that you had never seen it. So what did you think of Singin' in the Rain?
I just thought it was one of the most remarkable movies I'd ever seen. It totally lived up to anything I'd ever heard of it. It is a deliriously fun and perfectly executed from beginning to end. But in addition to loving it and becoming immediately infatuated with it, I discovered things about it and movie history that I didn't know going in. The first was that I always thought of Gene Kelly as just sort of a winning talent. And I came out thinking not only is he the most physically gifted human being ever to act on film, he's also a Hollywood auteur. Dane, I'm interested to hear your opinion on this. On par with Welles and Coppola, the degree to which he was actually the director of those films with which he shared credit with Stanley Donen. He brought Donen in mostly because he needed someone who wasn't doing the physically grueling work of dancing in front of the camera to quote-unquote direct them. But they were largely conceived down to the smallest detail by Kelly, you know, along with On the Town, which he co-directed with Stanley Donen. He really brought the American movie musical someplace completely new. It was so much his vision, and that was something I didn't understand. And the second thing I didn't know is I didn't know that the movie had a subject matter, which is the subject matter of the artist, right, which is the displacement of the silent film era by the talkie era. It's handled so gingerly, so lightly, but it really is sort of the story about whether and how long they'll cover for the character played by Gene Hagen, who represents this past that has to be displaced. And so it's a far more winsome story than I would have ever expected going in.
You know, in reference to Gene Kelly being the auteur, that's actually a highly disputed point in film history. And there was a bitter dispute between Stanley Donen and Gene Kelly their whole lives. I think they continued to have rapprochements and then fight again about it, about who was the auteur of Singin' in the Rain and
As
On
there
the Town.
Now is a bitter dispute between you and me, apparently, about
well,
who
and
the
Arthur
auteur
Fried, I just want to point out that an Arthur Freed, who's sort of parodied in this film, in the character of the producer, right, who produced this movie and also who wrote the lyrics to almost all the songs, was also a huge creative force behind the movie. So I do think that it is a classic product of the MGM studio system, as powerful as Gene Kelly's influence may have been on it.
Dana, I don't disagree with you. I guess I'm fascinated by the degree to which Kelly was one of the authors of this movie and On the Town, and the degree to which he was so articulate and self-conscious about it. Let me, to celebrate his 100th birthday, quote Kelly himself. He said about movie musicals, he said, "If the camera is to make a contribution at all to dance, this must be the focal point of its contribution, the fluid background, giving each spectator an undistorted and altogether similar view of the dancer and background. To accomplish this, the camera is made fluid, moving with the dancer, so that the lens becomes the eye of the spectator, your eye." Juliet, I discovered something about Gene Kelly that I never knew, which is that, I mean, not only is he really, his dancing is it seems to defy all laws of physics. He was capable of thinking about film the way Eisenstein thought about movie, about the relationship between the camera and movement.
That is fascinating. The other thing I learned in reading up on this movie and watching it again is what a taskmaster he was in those dancing scenes. I mean, one of the real contrasts when you think about this movie today is how light and effortless and charming and fun and joie de vivre it seems as you watch it. And apparently he was just grueling in the background, and he made Debbie Reynolds practice that good morning scene until her feet bled, supposedly.
And the anecdote about her crying underneath the piano on set, and Fred Astaire found her crying under the piano and helped her learn the dances because she wasn't up to Gene Kelly's, you know, standard for dancing. I love the idea of being discovered weeping under a piano by Fred Astaire.
Yeah, and I felt like I watched that scene differently with that knowledge in my mind. And you can, I mean, she keeps up, but you can sort of see there's the grin and the cocked head and the smile. And then there's a couple of moments of intense conversation as she's like tapping wildly up and down a set of stairs and doing contortions with her body that none of us could dream of. One other thing that struck me, though, about that lightness and the fun and the spirit of the movie was the news that it had dropped off the top 10 of the Sight and Sound poll of the 100 greatest films of all time, which is this august list put out by a British film magazine that's very snooty. And I just thought, why? One of the great set pieces in this movie, of course, is Make 'Em Laugh, the wonderful slapsticky dance number performed by Donald O'Connor, who also supposedly was worked so hard by Gene Kelly that he was hospitalized after taping it over the course of a week.
That is an incredible detail. I will never see that dance the same way again.
But, you know, the message of that song is that hustling for comedy is harder than and a more noble pursuit than making him weep. And I think Singing in the Rain stands as a testament to that.
Yeah, and in large part, that's what the film itself is about, right? I mean, it's about turning this serious silent film that was a complete flop into The Dancing Cavalier, a fun musical. And that wonderful Broadway ballet, which I think was a big point of dispute between Donen and Kelly. Gene Kelly wanted to have one of those Vincent Minnelli-style giant dream sequences that essentially drops the plot and is just about pure dance and song for 14 minutes, I think it goes on.
Yeah.
And I think alone among those MGM-style interpolation Broadway ballets, that one completely holds up, and just every minute of it deserves to be in there.
Well, we're all agreed they achieved a perfection or near perfection, and everyone should see this film.
Absolutely, if they haven't already. I'm also confused. How did you reach the age you currently are without having seen Singin' in the Rain? Were you resisting it?
Dana, the sentence, how did you reach your age without blank, covers so much of my existence that Singin' in the Rain is hardly where I'm going to begin and end that conversation.
But seriously, to grow up as an American without seeing Singin' in the Rain, you have to work at it.
Which one of us is the host of this show? Can we please move on?
Okay, then.
Coming up after a short break, we finally learn what a medieval cock and trice really is. You're listening to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf, along with Dana Stevens and Julia Turner, and this is the Culture Gabfest portion of the show. Moving on to our next topic, Julia, Burgerland, Chef Race, Chef Wants a Wife. These are, I'm not kidding you, these are the titles of forthcoming new food-based reality TV shows, of which there are already, we should mention, a ridiculous profusion. There are only more coming. In order to talk about what these shows are, whether there are too many of them, we all watched something called Time Machine Chefs, which was on ABC last Thursday. They only ordered up one to try to test it out. What did you make of that show, and what do you make of the phenomenon in general?
So Time Machine Chefs answered for me a question that I've long harbored deep within my heart, which is why don't I like food reality television shows more than I do? And the answer is because more of them are not more like Time Machine Chefs.
Tonight, four world-class chefs will be transported to specific times in history. In the end, three of them will remain trapped in time, with only one returning home to be named the greatest chef in history.
Time Machine Chefs is a marvelously schlocky show, the conceit of which is that four chefs are sent, quote unquote, back in time through the offices of a magical ice blue refrigerator, and they must then prepare a meal in a couple of hours with only the implements that would be available to them in a past kitchen. So in this pilot episode that we watched, they first traveled to Ming Dynasty China, where they had to make Peking duck while offensively clad Chinese onlookers watched. And then the winners of that round moved forward to Tudor England, where they were supposed to prepare a cock and trice, finally, for Henry VIII. And I learned, perhaps we all learned, that a cock and trice was a popular meal at the time, which involved taking multiple beasts and stitching them together into some kind of wild beast hybrid with, like, the head of a cod and the body of a lamb and the feet of a pheasant. And we got to see them trying to make this in a kitchen of the Tudor era, which involved little dogs that ran on dog-sized hamster wheels to turn the spits in the fire. All of this was marvelous television. I am very sad that this show will not have a longer life and that more food television shows are not like it.
It's not entirely clear that it will be one-off only. Julia, I'm totally with you. I thought it was delightful. Dana, what'd you think of it?
Well, it was kind of a great combination of the extreme camp of Japan Iron Chef in the framing. It almost brought me back to the one cooking show I've ever truly loved, which was the original Japanese Iron Chef, in that very, very campy trans-historical framing of being left behind in time if you fail the cooking competition. Like most reality shows, I found it way too long and way too padded. And this is, I guess, the reason that reality shows and cooking shows in particular never hook me in. They take so long.
The other problem that I have with reality shows is that you can't evaluate independently the work of the people. So I'm a big fan of the competition-based reality show. I don't like the reality shows where they put a bunch of hotties or weirdos in one house or neighborhood and then they follow them around as they say extravagant things to make us want to watch them more. That genre, no interest. The genre I like is where people ostensibly compete to showcase their skills. I understand that there's a fair amount of finessing, but at various points I've liked America's Next Top Model, which caused me to learn more about the art of editorial fashion photography, I'm not ashamed to say. Project Runway, which taught me a lot about cutting and sewing and draping and all kinds of fashion skills. I like some of the dancing shows, like So You Think You Can Dance. I feel like if you can watch the skills being performed, then when it's time for the judges to evaluate the work of the contestants, you have your own opinion as well. On the classic food show, on a Top Chef, the reason I never watched Top Chef, I can't tell. I just have to take the judge's word for it. They're putting these succulent morsels that look either good or disgusting in their mouths and pronouncing upon them, and I have no means as a viewer to independently evaluate whether the food is good or not at all.
Mm. Yeah, I agree with you, right? One judge on the panel says it's chewy. One says that it's tender. How do you know, right? But you know what I liked about the show is that, first of all, no one on it has a glaring personality disorder, right? There's no contrived villainy.
It's a pretty collaborative show, actually. When they're all putting together their three-part cock-and-trice meals, they're sort of commiserating with each other about the difficulty of prizing open a lamb's skull or whatever it
is.
Yeah,
and like feeding each other little morsels of meat and complimenting each other's work.
Yeah, the baseline tone is one of camaraderie and respect, which are typically undermined by the genre, and I like that about it enormously. I liked the possibility that you might actually learn something from the show, even though this trended in the direction of the schlocky. Had it been on PBS, it might have been a fully educational experience. But the concept is really good.
We learned something, right? We learned what a cock and trice is.
There you
and
go.
That dogs used to turn little hamster wheels to turn spits in Elizabethan England. That's pretty incredible.
And that they crisped the skin of Peking duck in ancient China by blowing into the duck skin to separate it from the meat.
You're right. PBS. It was great.
I learned a ton.
It seems as if the cooking shows just have to go further and further afield to have any kind of implementable gimmick, right? Because at this point, we've all seen a lot of straightforward cooking competitions in a kitchen. You've got to travel through time in a refrigerator, or you've got to chase across America in search of a chef wife.
Do you guys have a larger theory for the ascendance of these shows generally? I mean, is it just our larger obsession with food as a culture at the moment? Or is there something... I mean, I don't know. Is it like it turns this cold, inanimate flat screen on your wall into a glowing hearth full of hearty comestibles?
I can't go with you there. I can understand the association of good food with hominess, but I'd say maybe it's something – here's a completely potted theory coming out of nowhere. But what is the principal status symbol of the age of mass luxury that we've been living in since the late 80s or early 90s? It's got to be the high-end kitchen, right? I mean, that is the Sub-Zero fridge, the Viking stove. These super fancy kitchens are the first thing someone buys when they hit a certain level of affluence. And what do people do with them? You know, they make toast and spread peanut butter. I think that there's an odd discrepancy between the universality of those super fancy kitchens that you see in the house magazines and that people aspire to and the uses to which they're actually put. And so this is an obvious source of vicarious pleasure, but also schadenfreude, right? Watching people be forced to actually make use of these devices in a way that actually brings them a certain degree of pain somehow shrives the rest of us for having bought ridiculously expensive kitchenware.
Maybe
that we don't
that's
use.
Why this show isn't going to succeed, because there's no fancy kitchens in it. There's just retro kitchens.
I think you've got it.
But you right can there. Lord it over the people who have to strike a spark on two rocks instead of turning their stove
exactly.
on.
Exactly. You can lord it over the chefs of the Ming Dynasty. Well, moving on to our final topic, let me see if I can get this straight. Julia, watch me like a hawk here. But as I get the sequence, it goes like this. That originally in Slate, a writer named Jacob Silverman put forward an argument about the relationship between social media and literary criticism or book reviewing, in which he said that social media has tainted it by making it way too nice, that the era of liking things on Facebook and heavily networking with your friends on a peer-to-peer, constant peer-to-peer basis has blunted people's ability to be critical and honest. That argument was then picked up by the quite wonderful Dwight Garner, the book reviewer for the Daily New York Times. And he doubled down on it. He said, let me quote, he said, "Since childhood, I've been a loather of America's feel-good, everyone-on-the-tiptoes culture. Give me straight talk. Give me a little humor. Give me something real. Above all, give me an argument." Then it punted over to the also wonderful Laura Miller, the book critic at Salon, and she replied, no, this is total nonsense, that literary culture is, in fact, way too fragile and way too small to have the same hurly-burly kind of elbowy culture of reviewing that's totally appropriate for the world of film, for example, where, look, a billion people are going to go see Dark Knight, but maybe 400 people are going to buy a literary novel. Why is a certain kind of harshness or bluntness actually necessary? This has inspired a very widespread internet debate about the nature of criticism and niceness. Julia, did I make it through that alive?
Yes, although I think your estimate of viewers of Dark Knight and readers of literary fiction may have been slightly exaggerated, but I'll allow it.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. Dana, let me turn to you now and ask you. You're a critic. You're a critic on a regular basis. You walk a very specific beat of movies. What do you make of these various arguments?
You know, I really just sort of like the fact that there's this very lively debate happening about whether or not there's a lively enough debate happening in book criticism. I mean, it's certainly true that everybody who's reviewing books seems to have a very hot-button opinion on this topic. I think maybe I tend to side the most with Dwight Garner's point of view, but that may just be because he's such a lively writer that when I'm reading him, I think, oh, yeah, absolutely, I'm going with this. I'm not sure that I've noticed this endemic of niceness in book criticism or in any area of criticism, but that may just be because I don't keep up enough with contemporary fiction and reviews of it.
Well, and there's one key distinction between film reviewing and book reviewing, which is that you are not necessarily chummy on Twitter with a lot of like film directors and filmmakers and actors and actresses because they occupy an echelon of celebrity that's slightly different from the film criticism world. Whereas writers of books and writers of book reviews are often the same people.
Right. And the production really and the consumption are happening more in the same
pod of people, and they really are talking to each other and retweeting each other and living in this social sphere together in a more head-up way. So if you want to ravage a movie in one of your reviews and just take the wind out of it and say what a horrible piece of dreck you think it is, you can go ahead and do that, and you probably won't get like an emoticon sad face direct message from the director.
Quentin Tarantino sad face.
Right, or spat upon by Richard Ford. I mean, Dwight Garner goes into the history of people getting bad reviews and responding with intensity, sometimes physical intensity.
Well, this is what makes his piece so much fun to read. Whatever your opinion on whether criticism is too nice or not, is that he just has incredible anecdotes about bad blood flowing in the literary world.
It seems to me that there are two irresponsible extremes here. One is vendetta, right, getting back at someone for whatever reason, personal or otherwise. And the other is log rolling, which is just becoming involved in the world of mutual massage, right, and throwing love somewhat mindlessly at people that you like and expect a similar treatment from in the future. They're both terrible habits, and they both make for terrible criticism. I would say that this is also a generational story, that, you know, in the days of the partisan review, starting in the 1930s, 1940s, up through the 50s and 60s, that generation really believed you give as good as you get. I mean, we're thinking now about Mary McCarthy being the best example of that. I mean, truth happens when you smell blood, really, was the ethic of Norman Podhoretz and Mary McCarthy. And then that's been displaced, really. There's a new generation of writers that have produced journals like McSweeney's and The Believer that are explicitly – The Believer was explicitly launched with an essay with Heidi Julowitz about how they were not going to indulge in snark, that this was a counterpoint to the New York Observer and the Free Press. And then it's furthered along to Gen Y and the age of social media. I actually think there is a substance to the original argument by Jacob Silverman as picked up by Dwight, which is that the benefit of the bad review is that it will lend authority to the good review. And this is where I think I really pointedly disagree with Laura Miller. Mindless cheerleading is what is going to send people away from book culture.
But don't you think there's a distinction between reviews of books by literary lions and reviews of debut fiction? Because I think that's one of the schisms that we're seeing sprinkled throughout this entire conversation. I want to read a review of Zadie Smith's new book, which is coming out this fall, or the new Michael Chabon book that's coming out this fall. I want to read reviews of those both directions. I want all the critics I like best to weigh in on those books. On the other hand, if new writer Mosey Posey is coming out with a book and it's a piece of debut fiction and somebody thinks it's terrible, I don't really need to read that pan. And I do think there's a case that for debut fiction or for fiction by young writers, it's really not worth publishing that much unless it's a book that the critic really likes.
I totally agree with you.
So it's not a question of kissing up to writers, you mean, but to deciding what merits coverage.
I totally agree with you, but that's not the strong form in which this particular opinion has been formulated. Listen to what Dave Egger says, which Dwight Garner cites. Do not dismiss a book until you have written one. And do not dismiss a movie until you have made one. And Dave Eggers is no small player in this, right? I mean, not only the founder of McSweeney's, but a guy who sold God knows how many millions, tens of millions of books. I mean, he is in some ways the biggest literary celebrity of his generation, certainly, coming out and basically saying, I do not want there to be a culture of criticism at all.
10 years ago.
Well, what's the sell-by date on a powerful argument? 10 years? I mean, who cares that he said it 10 years ago? He's still the biggest literary celebrity of his generation. And by the way, still edits a literary magazine that operates according to that credo. The tender feelings of the person who produces a cultural object should not be on the mind of the person reviewing it, period. That's not to whom he or she owes some kind of an obligation.
You know, just one tiny thing to add about the social media angle of all of this. You know, there's these discussions about, you know, if you follow someone on Twitter, you're friendly, you send them smiley face emoticons when their book comes out, are you then not qualified to review their book? And I think that that is a legitimate question in this discussion, aside from are we nice, are we not nice enough, is just what is conflict of interest in the social media age, right? I mean, if you get assigned a book review, you're supposed to sign off. No, I don't know the author personally. I have no investment in this. And I guess in so much as there are different gradations of knowing now with social media, that's something to take into account.
Mm-hmm. Well, I love it. On our first radio show, we got hot. We got kind of worked up and hot.
Steve, I'll ask you to speak for yourself. I am as cool as a cucumber.
it's just that rugged tan. He's come back a changed man.
Julia, I want to take your temp, though. Where are we? Are you hot or cool? What are you right now?
98.6, baby.
In the shade. All right, let's move on. Now is the moment in our show where we endorse, and for our new radio listeners, let me just briefly explain. At the end of every show, each one of us, we go around the table and each one of us describes something that we've come across recently that we particularly like and want to foist upon listeners. Dana, let's start with you.
My endorsement this week is in honor of the director Tony Scott, who died this week under sad circumstances, taking his own life. And I look back in his filmography. I have to say that I'm glad I didn't have to write an obituary for Tony Scott, because there's many, many of his films in the past 20 years that I haven't seen. But I have very fond memories of True Romance, a Tony Scott film from 1993 that was written by Quentin Tarantino, actually in between Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction. So it's a great document of that time. It's Christian Slater and Patricia Arquette as a comic book store clerk and a prostitute on the run from gangsters. And I'll say no more, but if you've seen True Romance, you know what I'm talking about. Every performance in it is wonderful. Incredible small cameo by a very young Brad Pitt as a stoner who's key to the plot. And Christopher Walken, and just it's just one great performance after another and a lovely little movie.
There we go. Julia, what do you have?
I am endorsing Hit by Pitch, Ray Chapman, Carl Mays, and The Fatal Fastball, which is a graphic history written and illustrated by Molly Lawless. And it tells the story of the one time in baseball history when a pitcher struck a batter at the plate, and then that batter died the morning after. And it's a marvelously drawn and marvelously written story that gets into the histories of these two men, how they came to be facing each other on the plate that day, their varying temperaments, how they handled the catastrophe, and the general state of baseball in 1920, which is when this took place. You should check it out.
This week, I'm going to endorse one thing and one thing only. So easy for everyone to find. It's a song that I cannot get out of my head. It's so great. It's a brand new discovery. The song is called Boxer. It's by a band called Lover, which it's hard to find info about out there in the world. But the album is called Dark Light, and it's just terrific. I couldn't love it more. How's that for brief?
It would be briefer if you didn't talk about how brief it was.
Thank you, Julia.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Dana.
Thanks, Steve.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's show and to our Facebook pages at wnyc.org/gabfest. Our email address is gabfestradio@slate.com. slate.com. GabFest Radio is a production of slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Mike Voilo and Dan Pashman. Our interns are Jeff Friedrich and Sally Tamarkin. The executive producer is Andy Bowers. For David Plotz and the rest of the GabFest crew, I'm Stephen Metcalf. See you next week.